You know, Laurie...
Dr. Pollard revolves his chair.
The feelings you describe are far from unusual. When a person is in a vulnerable state of mind, the simple facts of day-to-day life can indeed seem overwhelming. And not eating is a common reaction to that sensation of being overwhelmed. We may think of food as the physical link tying us to the world. By refusing it, we attempt to disengage ourselves and our bodies from what we feel are the destructive intrusions of that world. But paradoxically, that act of self-assertion can be deeply harmful.
He crosses his legs so she can see his disgusting hairy white shins. She wishes Mr. Scott, the French teacher, was counseling her. She imagines him by her bedside, reading French poetry to her, explaining the vocab and the imagery. Elle est debout sur mes paupières, et ses chevaux sont dans les miennes.
The achievement of maturity, psychologically speaking, might be said to be the realization and acceptance that we simply cannot live independently from the world, and so we must learn to live within it, with whatever compromises that might entail.
And he wouldn't ask her questions. And because he didn't ask, she would tell him what it's like to be a person who is a ruin, who has done the worst thing she can ever imagine doing, whose life has become a series of lies that she lives trapped in between like a ghost, and all she wants is to be gone, gone, gone. Shh, shh, he would say, and he'd put his arms around her and just hold her. And he would not have gross, hairy shins. She knows Dr. Pollard only wants to help, but it would be so much easier if he left her alone. She wishes she could explain that she doesn't feel bad. Like, she knows what she's doing. It sounds weird, she knows, but it's like the thinner she gets, the better she feels. Like she's on a mountain that's growing out of the ground, carrying her higher and higher into the clouds, away from all the hands that might try and grab hold of her. She doesn't mind when the girls come to visit her and can't hide their disgust or their satisfaction at the way she looks now. And when Janine arrives for her big confession scene to tell Laurie about her and Carl, Laurie is not even angry. She watches Janine bawl and rub her fists in her eyes, sobbing. We couldn't help it, Laurie. We're in love. Like you would watch, like an insect or something gross like that, flipped over on its back or caught in a drain. She doesn't get angry. She doesn't tell Janine Carl still texts her, even though she can imagine herself saying it and enjoying how much it hurts Janine. Because Carl feels like a long, long time ago. She can't understand now how she ever wanted him or anyone to touch her. And Janine, too. These are all things that she's leaving behind. Every day she is more free, free of herself or what people thought she was. And soon she will be totally free as the air. Inside Lala are the pills she bought from Carl with her kisses. Now they will be kisses to herself, kisses to say, I love you, Laurie. Who else would kiss her, with the taste of death on her breath all the time? The real taste underneath everything, and now she can taste it all the time. But soon she will never have to taste anything again. The plan is ready. The new plan. Her plan. The singing girls on their way. They will come singing, Laurie, Laurie, on the wind. And she will dance away, graceful as a ballerina. Hey, can she hear them now? Is there someone calling her name? Someone right under her window? But when she pulls back the curtain, the figure she sees below is not a girl, and he is definitely not thin. Howard is amazed how quickly he loses track of things without the clanging school bell to chop his day into 40-minute portions. Darkness seems to fall shortly after he's got out of bed. He finds himself increasingly dependent on the TV for any sense of reality. And whenever there is a power cut, he experiences, in that first second of darkness, before his eyesight adjusts, a terror that it is he, in fact, who has been switched off. Yesterday, Finian O'Dolig had appeared at his door with a card signed by the whole Seabrook faculty. At first, Howard thought it was for him, a gesture of support. It wasn't, of course. It was for Tom Roach. There was going to be a presentation during the concert, an award for his years of dedicated service to Seabrook.
"I didn't think you should be left out,"
O'Dolig said considerately.
"Thank you,"
Howard said. He wrote his name on a blank space in the interior. After some deliberation, he left it at that. A presentation for his years of dedicated service to Seabrook. Today, on his way home from the supermarket with a bootful of discount beer, Howard stopped his car outside the police station. He sat there for 5 full minutes in the cold. Then he pulled out again and drove home. He starts drinking early, and as the fatal hour of the concert approaches, combines it with a half-hearted sally against the creeping entropy that has been taking over the house. He doesn't get far. Before long, he's hunkered on the floor with a box full of Halley memorabilia. Photographs, cinema stubs, museum plans from foreign cities, all spread out in front of him. This has been happening a lot lately. The feebler his grip on the present, the more vivid the past, which for so long he has let disappear behind him, a frothing wake swallowed in the cold, endless ocean of a world's lived lives, seems to become. This sense is only amplified when the power goes and he has to light a candle to supplement the waning daylight. He doesn't mind. On the contrary, he feels like he could happily spend the rest of his life here, revisiting city breaks, holidays, friends' parties. He only wishes he had Halley with him, so he could say, "Hey, look at this one. Do you remember such and such?" And hear her reply, "Yes, yes, that's how it was." And then at the back of a cupboard, he finds the camera, the magical summer camera, the one she was reviewing a couple of months ago, with a sense of exhilaration, knowing that it contains actual moving images of her. He switches it on. And moments later, there she is, that day in the kitchen, with a cigarette in her hand and the light falling across her. His heart leaps, watching her shimmer at him from the screen, and then sinks, as the little scene disintegrates, inexplicably and inexorably, into a fight. He plays the clip again with numb fingers, watching their conversation unravel, listening to her tell him to forget it, to put that thing away. Even on the tiny screen, the sadness etched into her face is unmistakable. "You did that, Howard." Everything clangs like bells inside his head. He switches off the camera and sets it down. He scoops up the photographs and stubs and tickets, but the box slips from his grip and the contents, all those days so carefully misremembered, scatter across the floor like orphans escaped from an ogre's cellar. He lets out a roar. He bends again to pick them up, but this time manages to scorch his elbow on the candle. "Fuck it! Fuck!" Grinding his teeth in rage, he flattens his hand and thrusts it palm down into the flame. He holds it there for as long as he is able, and then for a little while more, until all thoughts have been seared from his head, and then still more. Tears run down his cheeks. Lightning bolts flash beneath his eyelids. The pain is astonishing, like a new world underneath this one, raw and vivid and shivering. The air fills with the smell of cooking meat. Finally, with a cry, he pulls his hand away and staggers to the bathroom. His whole hand is inert. It feels like an alien substance, a lump of fire, or of pure pain grafted onto the end of his arm. When he runs cold water over it, it's like his whole body has been hit by something, like a knight lanced in a joust, or two waves clashing, matter and antimatter. One forgets quite how painful pain is, how literal and unironic. He stands there sobbing, the water drilling into his flesh, the agony shrill in his ear like an alarm. His mind, however, suspended above the scene, is suddenly crystal clear. The car park has been decked out with blue and gold fairy lights. Nice touch. Trudy's idea. From the top of the steps to the sports hall, acting principal Greg Costigan watches the guests arrive, proceeding from their cars in dinner jackets and long, elegant gowns. The yard's school-day soundtrack of high-pitched expletives replaced with a stately, dignified murmur. They can see him, too, framed in the glowing threshold of the hall, waiting to greet them like, he supposes, the captain. The captain of a ship. The good ship Seabrook. Looking out on all this magnificence and decorum, the word that comes unavoidably to mind is vindicated. Greg would be the first to admit it has not exactly been plain sailing here in the SS Seabrook these last few months. The Juster episode, discipline issues, poor rugby performances. In uncertain times like these, most men in his position would have been inclined to keep their heads down, weather the storm, not attempt a high-profile, high-risk venture like this. But Greg is not the kind of acting principal who shrinks from adversity. A bold gesture was what was needed to stop the rot. Something big and showy and extravagant. To rally the shareholders and generally boost confidence. Because a school, as well as being like a ship, is also like a market. And when the market is confident, it doesn't actually matter what small technical hitches might be going on behind the scenes. And, thus far at least, that decision has been 100% borne out and vindicated. An atmosphere of excellence, the kind that cannot be bought, pervades the hall tonight. Sprinkled in among the parents, it's a full house, by the way, bearing out and vindicating his decision, re-ticket pricing, is a sort of best of Seabrook, some of the leading lights of the last 30 years. Sportsmen, captains of industry, media personalities. Basically, the cream of Irish society. A hell of a turnout, and a testimony to that special bond Seabrook creates. As Greg explains to Frank Hart, class of 68, scrum half for Ireland, 1971-78, now in property development, and a millionaire several times over.
Doesn't matter whether you graduated 5 years ago or 55. You'll always be part of the family. In today's modern world, that's a rare and precious thing.
Father Furlong coming tonight?
Hart inquires.
I wish, Frank, I wish. Because in a way, this night is for him. A tribute to him and his predecessors and the great gift of education they have given to so many generations of Irish boys. Unfortunately, he's not yet well enough to leave the hospital, which is a real shame.
Leaves the stage clear for you, though?
Quips Hart. Greg laughs artificially.
Ha ha! Those would be some hard shoes to fill.
Of course, Frank Hart is totally right. This 140th anniversary concert marks the changing of the guard. Surely by now even the paracletes must recognize their time is up. You can't get away with hiding behind a crucifix these days. Whoever steps into Desmond Furlong's small and somewhat effeminate shoes will have to be able to reckon with the realities of 21st century life. Could Desmond Furlong have organized a 140th anniversary concert to be broadcast live to the whole country? Let alone faced down a potential scandal that might have destroyed the entire school? Somehow Greg thinks sitting in a traditional African chair watching fish swim around might not have been quite enough this time, and the paracletes know it. So this is, in some ways, a sad occasion. He segues in his imagination into a kind of acceptance speech, delivered to a hall much the size of this one, similarly filled with notables, marking, as it does, the passing of an era. But in other ways, it is a joyful one, because it proves that, although the Paracletes may be gone, for all intents and purposes, their values will live on. Maybe the men upholding them will wear a suit and tie instead of a dog collar. Maybe they will carry a laptop instead of a Bible. And maybe common business model, not God, will be the name of the bridge they use to bring communities together. But although appearances may change, the values themselves remain the same. The Seabrook values of faith, decency, various others. Yes, indeed, as he surveys the scene, the towering sound system, the radio engineer at work behind the desk, the first of two cameramen panning over the audience, the majestic banners and pennants, actually sourced outside the school at the last minute, the art department's offerings having been disappointingly slipshod, frayed hems, uneven lettering, misspelling of Christ as crit, etc. The audience members perusing with interest the gold-trimmed, white and blue envelopes left in their seats, which contain exciting news of a forthcoming Seabrook-affiliated credit card. Greg is thinking that tonight will have done him no harm at all. No harm at all. Now he only has to keep his eyes peeled and make sure nothing goes...
Ah, look what the cat dragged in.
In an instant, Greg has slipped through the crowd to pounce on the rumpled figure arguing with the ticket checker on the door.
Howard, fantastic to see you. What can I do for you?